Experts claim there is nothing tougher than a diamond. But at Diamonds Direct, we beg to differ. Have you ever met a mother? Strong, radiant, timeless. This Mother's Day, give her the gift that meets her match. With diamond jewelry starting at $200, plus Diamonds Direct's exceptional quality and unbeatable everyday price, you're sure to give her a gift that wows this generation and the next to come. Experience the thrill of jewelry shopping done right at Diamonds Direct. Diamonds Direct. Your love, our passion.
Trinity School of Natural Health can help you be part of the fast-growing health and wellness industry. With an education that empowers communities, Trinity grads can change lives by applying natural health principles and techniques in holistic practices or stores selling nourishing health products. Offering 19 online programs that fit your busy schedule, you'll get training to help turn your passion into a career. Enroll today at trinityschool.org. That's trinityschool.org.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Welcome to the Psychology Podcast, where we give you insights into the mind, brain, behavior, and creativity. I'm Dr. Scott Barry Kaufman, and in each episode, I have a conversation with a guest who will stimulate your mind and give you a greater understanding of yourself, others, and the world we live in. Hopefully, we'll also provide a glimpse into human possibility. Thanks for listening, and enjoy the podcast. Today, it's an honor to have Dr. Sean Carroll on the podcast. Dr. Carroll is a theoretical physicist at the California Institute of Technology. Recently, Carroll has worked on the foundation of quantum mechanics, the arrow of time, and the emergence of complexity. He has been awarded prizes and fellowships by the National Science Foundation, NASA, the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, among others. Dr. Carroll has given a TED Talk on the multiverse that has more than 1.5 million views, and he has participated in a number of well-attended public debates concerning material in his latest book, which is called The Big Picture on the Origins of Life, Meaning, and the Universe Itself. Sean, so great to chat with you today.
Thanks for having me on, Scott.
Yeah, I've been really looking forward to this chat. My whole life, I've been deeply plagued by these existential issues, and it's so exciting to finally talk to someone who kind of tell me what the probabilities are about these things, actually, you know, without me having to have no priors whatsoever, as I'm just like laying in bed thinking about this stuff.
You know, it's very interesting to me how few physicists worry about this stuff. Like,
really?
Part of it is just that we're trained not to talk about these things, right? You know, by these things, I mean, like, what if the universe didn't exist? Why does it exist at all, right? I talk about this a little bit in the book that I'm writing right now about quantum mechanics, but we are really trained to solve tangible, specific, put your finger on them problems. Physicists are trained to not think about more philosophical issues. So in some sense, the people best trained to address these issues about why the universe is here are reluctant to even address the issue.
You know, I do think that is, I can actually verify that a little bit. I did this event called the Physics Imagination Retreat. I had a whole series of retreats that when I worked at the Imagination Institute at Penn, and one of our retreats was physics. And I had a conversation with about six or seven of the top physicists at Cambridge, and I asked all these questions I've just been wondering my whole life. I was like, well, time travel would be possible. And people were like, who cares? And I was like, oh, is, you know, all the things that, like, as a human being, I care about, right?
Right.
And people were just like, I don't know, maybe not. It's just like, why do you not care? Why is that not so fascinating to you too, that question, you know, that I just asked? So I can verify that.
Yeah, and I suspect that most physicists were initially drawn to the field by those kinds of questions, but it does get beaten out of you. I mean, it might be true. I don't know. I mean, I didn't get beaten out of me. It might just be that other physicists were never interested in those questions. But yeah, I suspect that there's a selection effect. Academia, if you worry too much about those things, we're not going to give you a job.
Yeah, that's why I don't have a job in physics.
There you go.
So, okay, let me ask you a question. You call yourself a cheerful naturalist. Can you tell listeners a little bit what a naturalist is and what would a pessimistic naturalist look like?
Sure. I mean, a naturalist is just someone who thinks there's one world, the natural world. the world that we see around us is basically our experience of this natural world. So almost always, these words, which are very simple, but maybe you can worry about their definitions, go along with some other presuppositions. Like one is basically the conventional notion of the supernatural world is not there. That's the most important thing about naturalism, is that there's no supernatural world. There's no gods or spirits or anything like that. There's a complicated thing we get into about consciousness that maybe we'll get into about consciousness.
Oh, we will.
Yeah, we will. Okay, good. The other thing that is more or less implicit in the conventional use of the phrase naturalism or the word naturalism is the idea that we can learn about the natural world through scientific experimentation, through empirical means. We can go poke at the world and therefore learn about it. So, I mean, that's basically it. But, you know, for all intents and purposes going through the day, naturalism is opposed to supernaturalism, and in many debates, it's naturalism versus theism in particular that people care about.
Okay, and then the cheerful part, where's that coming?
Yeah, so you might not be cheerful if you were, you know, I think that even though there's a growing number of naturalists in the world, our background cultural conversation is still pretty theistic in its presuppositions. So there's an idea that purpose and meaningfulness in our lives comes from something beyond us, comes from something beyond the natural world, right? It's given to us by God, or there's just some teleology, there's some point to life that we're headed toward, etc. And so if you start from that starting point, you can still deny that there is anything beyond the natural world, but then you might feel a lack, a gap, right? A longing, like, well, now I don't have any purpose or meaning in my life. What is it all for? And, you know, we had 100 years of existentialists arguing about this, right? From Kierkegaard and Nietzsche through Sartre and Camus. And, you know, mostly they landed on the right answer, which is that we human beings make up purpose and meaning for ourselves. And so I'm in this sort of post-existentialist phase. So I can say, yeah, I'm a human being. I make up purpose and meaning for myself. That's great. I'm very cheerful about that. I don't feel this existential dread about it.
Wait, I've never heard that phrase, post-existential phase. Did you just make that up?
I just made it up. Yeah, I'll copyright it. I'll quickly write an article about it so that it...
because no, it's kind of awesome. Like, it's meaningful. There's a stage, and I can see how people embracing that sort of post-existential philosophy.
Well, and I think that going along with the idea that many physicists don't think deeply about whether or not the universe should exist, many atheists slash naturalists in the modern world say or pretend or have a pose that says, oh, it never should have bothered us that God doesn't exist because, you know, God didn't serve any purpose whatsoever. I think that actually, and this is one of the reasons why I put together this workshop called Moving Naturalism Forward a few years ago, because I think that accepting naturalism leaves us with plenty of important questions yet unanswered, and purpose and meaningfulness are one of them. I don't think you should give a glib, simple, off-the-cuff answer to those questions. So I think that, you know, the existentialists worked hard at trying to figure this stuff out. But it's funny, though, you know, someone once said fairly recently, like, no one in philosophy departments describes themselves as an existentialist anymore. Mm. But maybe that's just because we absorbed that lesson a little bit too thoroughly. And so I think that there's still work to be done in establishing how we can create purpose and meaningfulness and mattering and morality and ethics in a natural world. So we don't speak the language of the existentialists very much anymore, but the task remains unfinished. So post-existentialist phase is, I think, the right one.
Yeah. They got some stuff wrong, right, from like a psychological perspective. The idea that existence precedes essence. Now we know that, holy cow, you know, DNA predicts existence more than they ever could have imagined, right?
They were better at ethics than at metaphysics.
Or psychology.
Or psychology. Yeah. I don't doubt that they were better at ethics than at psychology. Yeah. But they wrote great novels, right? There were some great novels, you know?
Yeah, there were some great novels. And some of the sentences they wrote were very poetic.
Yeah, that counts for something.
And it does count for something. Well, it does. And I could actually see that segueing to your notion of poetic. Was it poetic naturalism?
Poetic naturalism, yes, that's right.
So did you like that segue?
Yeah, that was very good. Excellently done.
Fellow podcaster. By the way, I just want to say, step back and say congratulations on the huge early success of your podcast. I mean, it's only been like 3 months or something. Is that right?
Yeah. It's been very gratifying. And, you know, there's ups and downs. And you know, there are people in the comments who want to, you know, be cause trouble. But, you know, for the most part, yeah, both people have liked it. And, you know, people have said nice things on the internet about it, which is kind of amazing. So most importantly, I'm having fun. I've got to talk to a lot of fascinating people by doing it.
It's so much fun, isn't it? Doing a podcast and not being tethered to any rules about, you know, how to have discourse. I mean, we can just have an open and see a conversation and let it emerge, let the complexity emerge, right?
Yeah. And, you know, one of the, you know, tussles that I see in the comments to mine are there's definitely a minority slice in there that only want me to ever talk about physics. Oh. And, you know, they have not read the instructions because I'm very clear that the whole point of my podcast is to talk about lots of things other than physics, including physics.
I wonder if I'm going to get in trouble in this episode for talking about physics.
Yeah, you might. Well, we'll talk about psychology a little bit, so it's okay.
Oh, no, we'll get to it. And we're going to actually weave. I have this whole plan in my head, but we're going to let it emerge and we're going to let the plan emerge. So poetic naturalism, can you tell me a little bit about what the poetic part of that is now that you've laid out what naturalism is?
Yeah, so I think that one way in which naturalism can veer a little bit off the rails is, so what I said is the way that we learn about the world, the natural world, is through scientific exploration. Scientific exploration or experimentation is not the only way to learn true facts. For example, math or logic are different than science. You know, they go by formal rules that get you certain results, whereas science is much more tentative and about probabilities and credences, not about certainties. Nevertheless, some people want to say, you know, that science can do everything. For example, it can get us morality or meaning, things like that, right? And I just think that's wrong. I think that's not what science does. Science tells us what happens. That's what it is. It tells us what the world is made of and what that stuff does. That's pretty good. That's a lot of, you know, fills a lot of time, but it doesn't tell us what should happen or why we should care about what happens. These are different questions. So the poetic naturalism comes about by the idea that, number one, even at a scientific level, there's more than one way to talk about the universe. So there's one world, the natural world. There's more than one way to talk about it. We can talk about it as particle physicists, as chemists, as biologists, as psychologists, etc., right? These can all refer to real things in the world. I think that tables and chairs are real. Not everyone agrees, but this is the hill I'm willing to die on. And I think that if you think tables and chairs are real, then you probably think that you should think that consciousness and free will are real. But that's still just the scientific descriptive view of the world. So poetic naturalism says there are other vocabularies we can use for describing the world that are not tied down by the scientific method, such as our moral or ethical vocabularies, judging right and wrong. Ultimately, two people can judge a certain action right or wrong and disagree with each other, and there's no experiment you can do to show that one of them is right, one of them is wrong, right? It's not science. That's the whole point of science, is that in principle, there's data you can collect to adjudicate disagreements, and in morality, that's not true. So poetic comes in because there's more than one way to be a moral person or to find meaning and purpose in life. And so there's a bit of human creativity that comes in to talking about the world in those ways. At the end of the day, you're still just talking about the natural world, but you're assigning properties to it of being moral, being immoral, being something we want to strive toward or something we can just ignore, that is on the basis of, you know, your personal predispositions just as much as it is the action of the physical world around you.
Yeah, I mean, you just triggered the psychological component there, right? I mean, there's individual differences, and that influences our the worldview we develop, the environments we create for ourselves. The more that we create those sort of bubbles for ourselves, the more we start to ignore a broader picture, things like that.
Well, I think, you know, it becomes especially important to get this right when it comes to morality and action in the world, right? Now, you know, I think that so much of our moral discourse is still embedded in this somewhat religious background. And I don't think that the public face of naturalism is doing ourselves any favors because it's trying to be to go too far in, you know, deriving right from wrong from science, which can't be done. So I think we need to elevate our game a little bit here. And ultimately, it comes down to the fact, are you willing to admit, or the question, are you willing to admit that choices about right and wrong can be subjective? That there's no experiment we can do or mathematical proof we can offer that shows that something is absolutely right or wrong.
Yeah, I was going to get to the moral psychology later, but I do find that a truly interesting question from an individual differences perspective, because we use labels in our field to describe certain personalities as dark, the dark triad. I don't know if you've come across the dark triad. So that's narcissism.
I've heard the phrase, yeah.
Yeah, narcissism, Machiavellianism, and psychopathy. And, you know, in one sense of description, we're not actually, I mean, that's a subjective term that us humans, researchers, nerdy scientists have decided to label a constellation of traits. When we start talking about what is the fundamental nature of reality, because that's what we're talking about, ontology, you know, that is a concept. You know, there's a level of description from physics, from your point of view, where that constellation of personality traits are literally just a patterns of atomic particles that have self-organized at a particular moment of time, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a level of description upon which dark triad has no meaning. Do you see what I'm saying?
Oh, yeah. No, absolutely. Yeah. I think that's exactly right. So look, tables and chairs have no meaning at the level of description of particles and forces, right? So,
yeah.
I mean, this is the point I'm trying to make that I completely agree with, that there's only one world, but there's more than one way to talk about it.
Yeah.
That's the short gloss on poetic naturalism. And nobody should disagree with this. There are some very, very hardcore eliminativists that want to say, you know, friends of mine, to be honest, that want to say the only thing that exists is this deepest substructure of reality, the particles and forces or the quantum wave function of the universe or something like that. But look, they prove themselves wrong every time they do anything in the world, because of course they talk about tables and chairs, right?
Yeah.
Tables and chairs are real phenomena. They're, you know, Daniel Dennett talks about real patterns. They have causal efficacy and explanatory power in the world. You could talk about a table in terms of all of its atoms and the forces holding them together, but that's dumb. It's, you know, an enormously inefficient way to talk about this emergent pattern. Emergence happens when there's an enormously more efficient way to get useful information about a situation without going to that fundamental substrate.
Yeah, I wouldn't recommend going to that fundamental level on a first date, at least.
Well, exactly. I made that joke, right?
Yeah. Oh, you've made it too? Are we both do we both have our awkward senses of humor?
Well, I totally, you know, so I get an extra bonus because my version of the joke is when you go on a first date with someone and they say, tell me about yourself, you don't start listing all of your atoms, right? All the positions and velocities of your atoms.
That's right. That, that's right.
If your first date is with a Caltech student, that might actually work. So.
Okay. Fair enough. Oh, that's so funny that you thought you were thinking something similar. Yeah. So, I mean, there's so many pathways to go in this conversation, because people make a distinction, as you talk about in your book, between rich ontology and sparse ontology. And I think that is relevant here. Could you please explain to our listeners the difference between these two forms of understanding the nature of reality?
Yeah, I think this is really important, because we have to admit that when we're facing these issues that are deep and difficult and we don't know the answers, you know, until we know the answer, right? Until the answer is just bleeding obvious, as long as you're in that phase where things are still a little bit up for grabs, our human personalities and preferences and predilections affect the hypotheses to which we attach the most credence by a lot, right? Different people have different kinds of, you know, love for different kinds of scientific hypotheses. Maybe psychologists should look at this. Certainly philosophers or sociologists of science should look at this. But of course, we hope that eventually the data decide and we all agree. But the interesting part of science, and we don't yet have enough data, we don't yet agree. So when it comes down to the deepest level, right, like what is the world, right? What is the world at a fundamental level? Some people are going to prefer an explanation which is more or less very close to the phenomena. So we see tables and chairs, and we see people who have purposes and meaning in their lives. So some people are going to naturally want those things that you see to play a role in their fundamental ontology. I mean, consciousness is the way that this shows up a lot. But for Plato, it would have showed up in tables and chairs. He actually wants them to be part of the fundamental ontology. We can't get away with that today, but a lot of people would still want human consciousness to be there. And other people are willing to give up that closeness of fundamental ontology to experience in favor of the ontology itself being very, very lean and mean. This is the sparse ontology. So if I can claim to have a really, really simple, elegant, very compact, easily written down ontology, and then I can claim that if I work hard enough at unpacking the predictions or the implications of that ontology, I can explain the world, then that's another kind of triumph that you might want to claim. I'm definitely on the sparse ontology side of things. I'm very, very minimal in my preferred view of the underlying world. Of course, the data could always prove me wrong, but that's what I'm betting on right now.
Yeah. So you write, we will ultimately understand the world as a single, unified reality, not caused or sustained or influenced by anything outside itself. Could some people view that statement as arrogant, in a sense, that you are so confident about that?
So strictly speaking, the answer to your question is yes, obviously, because they have and they do.
Okay. So people have, maybe I should have phrased it that way.
Should. Because, you know, it's, I mean, you have two options. The world exists all by itself, or the world is sustained by something outside it. Nobody knows with 100% certainty which option is correct. Many of us have opinions about the relative likeliness of these two different options. I don't think it's arrogant or otherwise to say which your preference is, right? I don't see why it would be any less arrogant to say the other side. You know, I think as soon as people start talking about arrogance, they've stopped having a good faith conversation about ontology, right? You know, if you want to say the evidence is against my view, then that's fine. Or if you want to say, like, here's the experience we have that leads us to think that there's a better view, that's fine. If you just say that, you know, I'm arrogant, then you're just switching to ad hominems at that point. You're not trying to argue with the claim.
No, I totally hear you. I'm trying to think of, like, at what level of probability are you allowed to say something with confidence without putting all the caveats around it? Right? Because you could have phrased that sentence, you know, based on my current priors and the current evidence that I've amassed over a career of studying this stuff, my current understanding and prediction is that we will ultimately understand the world, blah, blah, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
But you stated it, we will understand. And, you know, there are a lot of things during the course of my day, I wonder, like, what should be my threshold for having confidence? You know, for a whole wide range of things, like crossing the street, you know, like, what's the probability that I can confidently, you know, cross the street right now? What is the probability, et cetera, et cetera. Have you thought about, like, you know, if you want to live your life really, like, rationally, every second of your life, like, what's a good guideline for that? Like, I mean, above 50% seems right to me, but what above 50%? Are we talking 90%, like 91%? Because you could be wrong in that statement and you admit that, but you still state it confidently because it's higher than what, 90, would you say, percent? What would you say?
I would, you know, no, I would go, I think it depends on context a little bit, right? I mean, I forget exactly how I phrased that statement, but, you know, it's after
I... You said, we will.
We will. Well, what was the beginning of that? We will.
Oh, fair enough. Okay. I would need to look that up. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, it might be something like, I believe we will, or, you know, okay. I'm confident we will, or something like that. Yeah. You know, the sun will rise in the east tomorrow, right? I can't say that with 100% confidence. And yet when I say it, I don't feel the need to add footnotes about the relative likelihood and stuff like that. I think that that one I would put better than 99% probability on.
Wow.
You know, for the world, you know, not having an external mover, I would probably also put greater than 99% chance on
that's
personally.
Huge. I mean, like, if people really... Okay, look, I need to step back a second because this is... I'm not sure people really might really get exactly how big that is. In a way, you know, throughout the course of human history, people have been conjecturing about the fundamental nature of reality or about the existence of God. And even today, a lot of people have certain religious beliefs, certain specific beliefs. You're saying that there's like a 99% probability that some people and their beliefs that they hold so dear is just simply wrong. Incorrect.
Yeah. The only part of that I would disagree with, or footnote, since we're trying to be very, very careful right now, there is a probability. I think that these probabilities are subjective. That's Bayesian inference for you. Everyone has a credence for different things to be true. My credence that God exists and sustains the universe is less than 1%. Yes.
Based on your credences, which are facts.
I used to believe in God when I was a kid, and, you know, more data came in, and I processed the data, and I updated my credences, and, you know, the world just makes so much more sense as a world that doesn't have God in it. Now, of course, in any, you know, we can always spend plenty of time debating what is meant by God, so, a somewhat traditionalist view of God, the kind that typical religious believers believe in.
So, are facts... By the way, I'm trying to be skeptical here from the point of view of someone that neither me or you are, because I'm in more your camp about how I see the world. And but I'm trying to think of, like, why do facts, and this might be an obvious answer, but I could see someone asking, why do facts take priority in credences over experiences? Like, someone else could say, well, my credences throughout my life are like, I talk to God at night when I pray, right?
Yeah. No, so, those totally count.
Yeah.
Those experiences are facts. That is... data
okay.
in the Bayesian way of thinking about it. Like, I talked to God, I had this experience, therefore I'm going to update my credences.
Okay.
You know, that's perfectly legitimate by itself. Now, you should also be thinking, you know, what Bayes tells us to do, I don't think he told us to do. And by the way, he believed in God. He was a reverend, Thomas Bayes.
That's funny.
What he would have said is, look, you can't just figure out whether or not you would have had this experience if God existed. You also need to ask, what is the chance you would have an experience like that if God didn't exist?
Right. Right.
And so my point is that people who take that to be strong evidence are typically vastly underestimating the probability that something like that could happen even if God didn't exist. You know, the human mind, as you might know as a psychologist, things can happen in the human mind. Like, we can misremember things, we can imagine things, we can talk ourselves into things, we can hallucinate. You can have all sorts of experiences that make perfect sense in a naturalistic world that you could also interpret as spiritual or religious. So I think the probability of either one of these, under either one of these hypotheses, that things like that happen would be very high.
No, point very well taken. I mean, the human mind is massively biased and we've evolved illusions.
Yeah.
So I want to, as we're unraveling the probabilities of the reality of the universe, let's talk about how the universe probably evolved before we get to life. You know, maybe we should back up a second and start pre-life.
You talk about the universe, yes.
Yeah. It's very exciting for me, by the way. It's very exciting. I loved physics in college. I did a presentation on time travel. It got me an A. And that's like
excellent.
The claim to fame. At
Congratulations,
Carnegie
John
Mellon.
Scott, yes.
Yeah, thank you. So I'm so fascinated. So let's talk about how the universe actually evolved. Because reading your book, I realized that I learned a heck of a lot since when I took physics in college. I guess it would have been 2002. You know, like, I learned a lot of things from that have been updated since then. So tell us what our current best understanding of how our universe evolved is.
So it's been about 14 billion years since the Big Bang. So sometimes you'll hear people try to make it, you know, 13.7, 13.8. We don't know that third digit very well. So let's just say 14
billion.
Doesn't
matter at all
okay?
for us.
Yeah, exactly. So, oh no, there's very heated emotional arguments.
Really? Are there really?
13.8.
I love how within specific academic fields, there's such heated arguments about things no one else cares about.
So what does that mean, that there was a Big Bang? You know, we discovered in the 1920s that the universe is, number one, very big. You might have always thought that we knew the universe was very big. What we discovered is that these little blobby things that we see in the sky are actually separate galaxies made of stars. Right? Before Hubble came along, we might have thought that they were just clouds within our own Milky Way galaxy. So the universe seems to be this homogeneous spread of galaxies. Roughly 2 trillion galaxies is the best current estimate in the observable universe. And number two, we discovered that it's expanding. So the distance between galaxies is growing over time. So if you imagine winding that backward, in the past, things were closer together. And at one point, if you just keep going, it's natural to assume everything was on top of everything else. And that's what Georges Lemaître, another priest who was a scientist, called the primeval atom, and what we now call the Big Bang. So according to general relativity, right, Einstein's theory of gravity that says that space and time are curved, you can, again, plug into the equations and ask what things were like at the Big Bang. And the answer is there was a singularity, a moment of infinite density, pressure, expansion rate, curvature, and so forth. And in some sense, that suggests that it was the beginning of the universe. Like, there's no space-time beyond the Big Bang. Now, the truth is, the story I just told you is one you will often hear, but it's only half the truth. The other half is, there's no reason to believe general relativity in the regime of the Big Bang, because general relativity is a classical theory. It does not take quantum mechanics into account. Everyone knows that quantum mechanics matters in conditions where, you know, the density is very high and things are very energetic and things are all squeezed together. So the fact that there's a singularity predicted by general relativity at the beginning of the universe does not mean that the universe began at that time. All it means is that our classical way of describing the universe using general relativity breaks down.
Something big happened.
Something happened.
Phase transition or something of some sort.
Well, it's not the beginning of the universe. It's the end of our theoretical understanding is the way that I like to say. So it's very possible that that was the first moment in the history of the universe, the moment before which there were no other moments. But it's also very possible there was something before that that we don't know. So that's all mystery land, what happened at or before the Big Bang. After the Big Bang, you know, 1 second after the Big Bang, we have a very good handle on what the universe was doing. It was a nuclear reactor turning protons and neutrons into helium nuclei. And it's been expanding ever since. It was hot, so hot and dense that it was opaque for the first few 100,000 years. And then it became transparent and we can see the leftover radiation from that hot, dense early phase in what we call the cosmic microwave background. And we can, you know, back when we had television sets with antennas on them, some non-negligible fraction of the static in your TV set came from the cosmic microwave background radiation. It's all around us and it's there from the Big Bang. And we can learn an enormous amount about what things were like back then. And basically what things were like were very, very smooth. That was the interesting thing. There's not a lot of feature. There's not a lot of structure in the universe at that time. There's a little bit of variation of density from place to place, but not that much. And what has happened over 14 billion years is gravity has taken the regions with a little bit more matter and pulled things together to make them even denser, and regions with a little bit less matter and emptied them out to make them even less dense. So structure, the contrast knob on the universe has been turned up over these 14 billion years. And now we see a universe that is full of planets and stars and galaxies.
Right. And at that smooth stage, there was very low entropy, right?
Yes. So there's a whole complicated discussion about entropy. So even professional cosmologists get this wrong all the time. If you have a box of gas on your desk, for whatever reason, physicists do this sometimes, there's a box of gas on your desk, and you heat it up, and you let it go to its maximum entropy state. So entropy is a way of talking about the disorderliness, right? The randomness, the disorganization of things. So if you let things go all by themselves, there's the law, the second law of thermodynamics, that says that entropy goes up until maybe it hits a maximum and then it just remains constant. So the maximum entropy that that box of gas could be in, the maximum entropy state, if you open it up and look at it, it's what we call thermal equilibrium. It looks like it's very smooth, and it's giving off radiation with a certain very specific spectrum of different wavelengths. And when you look at the early universe, that's also exactly what you see. It's very smooth and it's giving off radiation with exactly that kind of radiation, that kind of spectrum. So physicists say to themselves, aha, the early universe looks like it is a very high entropy state, which is exactly wrong, exactly backwards. Because the reason why is there's something very, very different about the early universe than about your box of gas, namely, the early universe was really heavy. It had a lot of mass in it. It had a lot of gravitational pull to it. The box of gas on your desk, the gravitational pull between the different gas molecules is negligible. Gravity is a very, very weak force. But in the universe, the gravitational force is very, very important. Once you turn on gravity, a high entropy state does not any longer look like a smooth thermal box of gas. You could take that box of gas and turn it into a black hole, and you would have a much higher entropy. The early universe could have had a much higher entropy if all the matter that we see smoothly distributed had in fact been very lumpy, and in fact, best of all, if a lot of it had been in the form of black hole. So that's a puzzle. The early universe was actually, compared to what it could be, really, really low entropy. And low entropy states are very rare in the space of all possible states. You know, if you ask, how could the universe have looked at the beginning? What might it have looked like? You would never have chosen the actual configuration of the universe. It's just too unlikely. And why is that? There must be something. You know, maybe God did it. That's one of the explanations, but there are other explanations on the table also.
Yeah. Is it possible that when you have too much entropy, like that too much that the system can handle, like it explodes, like, and then enters a state of complete low entry, like kind of the cycle starts over again? Is that I think of it. Okay, can I just tell you why I bring this up?
Yeah.
Because I'm trying to make a linkage to my field. So there's Jacob Hirsch and colleagues of mine that have come up with this really neat theory of psychological entropy. They've taken the same principles of the second law of thermodynamics and they try to apply it to the mind and our need for certainty, you know, the human need for certainty.
Right. Sure.
And the theory of psychological entropy, you know, we get to this state where sometimes we get so overwhelmed by, you know, what people who are high on the personality trait neuroticism already walk around in a high state of entropy in their daily life. I laugh because that's basically me, you know, like, I can relate to that. Yeah, it's just like so much uncertainty and I can get overwhelmed. But then there's something that it's interesting happens psychologically when the system just gets so overwhelmed. And on a less humorous note, a more serious note, like people who've had abuse in childhood or very severe trauma actually get to a point where they just don't care anymore. They actually get to a point of, you could almost characterize it as low entropy, because there's just been too much entropy. So I'm just saying, like, if we have this analogous to the creation of the universe, is it possible that, like, there was a prior larger universe or prior different kind of universe that maybe was doing its own thing for like, this is just my imagination running wild, but kind of doing its own thing for like, you know, 100 trillion years, got to that state, the same state that we're predicting one Google years from now, all black holes in our universe will have evaporated into a thin mist of particles. Okay. Is it possible that happened already? And then what you naturally get as a result of that is like, plop, you know, like this very low entropy state. I don't know. Is this crazy talk?
It is partly crazy, but partly very sensible. So let me see if I can remember everything that I need to say here.
Okay.
To answer your immediate question, it's certainly possible that there was something before the Big Bang that we would have recognized as high entropy.
Yes.
In fact, this is my favorite theory that I've written about, you know, a way by using the mechanism that we used was, sorry, I need to back up a little bit. What would the universe look like if it were high entropy, you might ask?
Yeah.
And again, gravity is the most important thing here. And the answer is the universe would look like empty space if it were high entropy.
Right, which is what you predict eventually we're going to have.
Right, because entropy is growing. So if you just let the universe go, it'll empty out. And so the real cosmological question that none of my fellow cosmologists recognize is the right question, but it is why don't we live in empty space?
Yeah, no, that's a good, darn good question.
Why is there stuff in the universe?
Yeah.
Why are there the 88th particles around us? And so what we suggested, this is Jennifer Chen, who was a graduate student of mine, and I, in 2004, suggested, well, maybe there can be a quantum transition where you have a big empty universe, and it's almost like a little nucleus that is radioactive that spits off a photon or something like that. This big empty universe spits off a little baby universe.
Right, right.
That starts small and dense and energetic, and then what we would recognize as by itself very low entropy. But secretly, of course, it's part of this bigger system that is high entropy. So it's just a localized bit of low entropy. It's not the whole universe is going down in entropy, but the whole universe is creating a more universe that starts low entropy and then grows. That is absolutely possible.
Okay, now what's the crazy part?
Okay, the crazy part is I'm not sure that I agree with the analogy that the psychologists have suggested between entropy
and back channel. I'd love to send you the paper.
Okay.
So you can read it and I'll put it in the show notes. Yeah.
But it might be very fixable in the sense that human beings are quintessentially not closed systems, right?
That's right.
We interact with the environment around us. So the fact that entropy tends to go up, you know, if that's all you thought ever happened, that would mean that you could never take a bottle of champagne and cool it down in your refrigerator because the entropy of the bottle of champagne goes down. Of course, it's not acting all by itself. It's in a refrigerator, right? And the refrigerator is spewing heat out the back. So human beings, I don't think, are very well modeled as closed systems that obey the second law of thermodynamics, or to which the second law is relevant. Human beings are dynamical systems that are, you know, channels through which a lot of things come in and a lot of things go out. And so what you're really looking for is the different steady state configurations or quasi steady state configurations subject to these inputs and outputs. I think that you could try to model that with entropy-like notions, but the simple thing of looking at it as a closed system is not going to fit the data very well.
Yeah. So these are the four propositions, four major tenets of entropy, the entropy model of uncertainty. So one, uncertainty poses a critical adaptive challenge for any organism. So individuals are motivated to keep it at a manageable level. So uncertainty management is a huge thing that humans have. Two, uncertainty emerges as a function of the conflict between competing perceptual and behavioral affordances. Three, adopting clear goals and belief structures helps to constrain the experience of uncertainty by reducing the spread of competing affordances. And D, uncertainty is experienced subjectively as anxiety and is associated with activity in the anterior cingulate cortex and with heightened neuroadrenaline release. By placing the discussion of uncertainty management, a fundamental biological necessity, which I think is what you were talking about, within the framework of information theory and self-organizing systems, our model helps us situate key psychological processes within a broader physical, conceptual, and evolutionary context. So I presume you agree with that?
Well, yeah. I mean, the assumptions sound plausible on the face of them. Of course, there's probably some mathematization of them or formalization of them that goes into it. But again, I think that there's a missing ingredient there, which is the environment in which people are embedded. So, or even before that, there's I don't know how much we want to get into this. Like, give me a minute to just indulge myself here. You know, I think that much more emphasis needs to be placed on the idea of homeostasis. Mm. I know that Antonio Damasio has been writing about this idea. But here's the important fact as I see it. If you turn your computer on, your laptop, it doesn't do anything. Like, it turns on and just sits there. It doesn't get bored, right? It's not, you know, going to sort of twiddle its thumbs and be annoyed that you haven't given anything to do. It is happy sitting there for a very long time. Whereas a human being is not. A human being can meditate. You know, you can sit there and close your eyes and still your breath, and et cetera. But a human being is still a fundamentally really, really different thing than a computer or a chair. But the point is that a chair is more or less static because it's made out of pieces that are individually static, right? It's almost essentially a lattice of different atoms and molecules. Yeah. A person can be fairly static, but there's an enormous amount of activity going on underneath the surface, right? Yeah, at the very least, your heart is beating. There are chemical, electrochemical signals going down your central nervous system. ATP is being generated, right? So your staticness is being maintained by an enormous amount of activity beneath the surface. And that activity depends on the fact that you're embedded in an environment that is very, very far from thermal equilibrium. We bring in free energy, we use it up, we expel it. And that's a process that has to keep going. So if I were to build psychological models in a sort of a entropic or information theoretic framework, I would look for these quasi-static equilibria based on certain free energy inputs and high entropy outputs.
This is really exciting, actually. I read about this quite a bit in my book. As the physicist Erwin Schrödinger argued in his highly influential book, What is Life?, which you talk about in your book, so it's really cool to make these linkages. All living systems survive by reducing their internal entropy while necessarily increasing the entropy in their external environment. All living organisms reduce entropy by consuming energy in ordered states, such as food or sunlight, and using that energy to maintain their own order, but with various byproducts released back into the environment, such as heat and excrement, so that the sum total is that they increase entropy in general while maintaining their own low entropy. Humans aren't exempt from the second law of thermodynamics. The total amount of entropy or disorder in the universe will increase over time. Whether we like it or not, things fall apart. All organized systems will deteriorate and dissolve unless they are actively maintained, which require a constant supply of energy and resources from the environment, such as food, water, oxygen. Without these resources, our bodies and minds deteriorate and eventually cease to exist. When we consume energy from the environment, however, we necessarily destroy the order that existed there. Consider the immense amount of biological organization that is contained within every living thing. Consuming other organisms is necessary for us to maintain our internal biological order. However, in the process of doing so, we destroy the order that existed outside our bodies. Before we ate lunch, the plants and animals in our plants were organized systems. After lunch, the systems are absorbed into our bodies. Just like us, those other life forms were able to survive only by consuming energy from the environment and leaving disorder in their wake. The process of all living systems is therefore to minimize internal disorder with the effect of increasing external disorder. There are deep implications here, not just for our physiological functioning, but also for our psychology. And this is what the linkage I try to make in this new book I'm working on. This hasn't even been published yet, but I'm excited to get the opportunity to even just say it out loud to you. I mean, no one else is listening, hopefully. they've all tuned out by this point.
I have bad news for you, yes.
I know. We use a fair amount of physical energy to run our brains. Just tell me if this makes sense, because I tried to make this connection. We use a fair amount of physical energy to run our brains, which allows us to maintain a reasonable degree of predictability and coherence and determine what actions will move us closer to our goals. The more uncertainty we perceive in our lives, the more metabolic resources we waste and the more stress we experience. When internal disorder becomes too great, we are at risk of resorting to strategies that are destructive to others, not to mention to our own selves. Our sense of possibility shrinks and we're dominated by an exquisitely narrow repertoire of emotions, thoughts, and behaviors, leaving us with diminished potential to become the person we truly want to become. Okay, I'm going to stop there just to discuss this. So just the way I was thinking of applying some of those physics principles to the notion that we, you know, what does it mean when we have like high anxiety and like our whole world narrows into this one, like we rummage around. What is rumination? Rumination is when you rummage around in your prefrontal cortex and you can't get out of it, or, you know, a particular part of your neural structure, you can't like see a bigger picture. Do you see the linkage there?
Well, yeah, absolutely. But I think that there are, you know, things I would poke at. I mean, starting not with you, but with Schrödinger. It was a brilliant book, and I think it's very influential and very far-seeing. And everything he says is sort of mostly true, on the right track. But, you know, step one in a thousand-step journey, in some sense. For instance, he says, you know, we try to minimize the order within ourselves by the disorder within ourselves by increasing disorder around us.
Right.
that's going too a little bit too far. It's not clear that we minimize disorder. Huh. We have lower disorder than we could, but it's not at all clear that there's something quite as cut and dried as minimizing the disorder. You know, putting ourselves in a refrigerator would lower our disorder, and yet we don't do that, right? So I think that it's more subtle than that.
Wait, why would I lower my disorder if I put myself in the refrigerator?
Well, just as you lower your temperature.
Oh, I see.
There are fewer things that your atoms can do. Like if you froze yourself solid, you would have almost zero entropy.
I see. But not necessarily the disorder in my head, right? Like if I'm feeling anxious and I go in a refrigerator, will that actually calm me down?
So this was the other point I wanted to make. Yeah. You know, this is a doable thing, but it's important to do, which is to distinguish between the entropy or the disorder of the physical stuff of which you are made, including the neurons in your brain, and, you know, the higher level. As a poetic naturalist, we're allowed to talk about the higher level descriptions of, you know, your thoughts and beliefs and mental states and emotions. And, you know, these are things that we can also imagine being in states of more or less disorder. It might be more difficult to quantify that, but okay, we can, you know, we can approximate it. I think that there's something real in here. There's a few things going on, and I think that there's a lot of ideas. So I'd be reluctant to say which I think is right. You know, there's Carl Friston and his Bayesian brain ideas. So he's about
the brain as a prediction machine.
Right, exactly. And that makes perfect sense, you know, in evolutionarily, right? That we want to be able to make predictions about our environment as quickly and accurately as we can. Sadly, the desire to do that quickly competes with the desire to do it accurately. So that's why we invent heuristics and system one takes over all the time and things like that, right? So again, that fact there's this competition between quickness and accuracy might make it hard to identify something simple that is being minimized when the brain is doing something. But the other thing is, what we learn from neuroscience about the actual brain is that the brain, there's something nice about being in between a state of minimum order and maximum order. The brain is close to, but not exactly at a critical balancing point between these two states. Because on the one hand, you want to, I think this is part of this balance between being quick and being right. You know, if you have a machine, if you ask it a yes or no question, it always says no. That's very quick, but it might not be right all the time. If you have one that takes a long time to think about it, it might be right, but it might be dead before it gets around to answering it. So these, what we see in both in nature and in sort of self-assembled systems like the internet or something like that, is that hierarchical structures, which are not fully chaotic nor fully orderly, are often the best way to robustly deal with these problems of doing things both quickly and correctly. So
you just have me thinking now, is that possible that explains why consciousness evolved in the first place to give us that kind of equilibrium? But maybe there was a point in our evolution where our system one was getting too, was not being adaptive anymore. And we actually had to evolve some mechanism of control that would allow, kind of put the brakes on it a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's very similar to something I talked about in The Big Picture, which is an idea from Malcolm MacIver about the one of the great leaps forward in consciousness he suggests was when fish crawled out onto land. Right. And the idea was very close to what you just said. If you're a fish, all the evolutionary pressure is make decisions quickly because you can't see that far in water. Once you can see something with your eyeballs, it's right on top of you. You got to make a choice right away. On land, where you're seeing through air and you can see kilometers away, it opens up the space of ways to organize your brain to let yourself think a little bit more. Right. Even to imagine possible future alternative hypotheses and, you know, contemplate things. And we know, again, from neuroscience that contemplating, imagining the future happens in the brain using the same hardware that remembering the past does. So it's easy to imagine that fish evolved primitive memories and that then when they hopped onto land, they repurposed that little memory machine as an imagination machine. And that was one of the steps towards getting consciousness. Yeah.
Yeah. And I love that part, by the way. And yeah, I think you have like a picture of, that was cute around that section.
The fish.
You raised something that is really kind of gets the heart of what I've been fascinated with is the human imagination. And the default mode network is the seat of the kind of imagination you're talking about, the ability to, you know, to draw on the past in order to reconstruct a future. And mostly it's social content. So like the kind of imagination Einstein had or that you have in your work that you do is draws on a different network than the default mode network. It draws more on the visual spatial network. But the kind of, you know, those findings you're talking about episodic memory, it's a very social content. So that suggests like through the course of human evolution, we must have been very social creatures, you know, more so than thinking about the nature of the cosmos.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds perfectly plausible to me. I would not be, I'm not quite expert enough to say that it's right or wrong. But, you know, I think that to get back, you know, to touch it back to, you know, this issue of can we think about the brain in useful terms entropically?
Yeah.
You know, I think that it's fascinating to imagine that there are aspects of psychology that could be explained by either minimizing or maximizing or extremizing some information theoretic characterization of what's going on. I think that's very possibly true and could even, you know, in chaotic dynamical systems, we often see things that are more or less smoothly going on for a long time and bang, something completely unpredictable happens. So you might even be able to fit in sudden changes of psychological state into such a framework. But I think that it's going to be work to do it. I think that, you know, physicists who are, you know, again, physicists just do the simplest stuff, right? Like we think about
it's so simple, you know, the nature of the universe.
It's way easier than the brain. And yet, even physicists are reluctant to think about out of equilibrium dynamics, right? Yeah. Things actually changing in interesting ways. If you take a typical undergraduate thermodynamics course, they'll teach you what happens in equilibrium or very, very slowly changing. And if something changes rapidly, like, well, I don't know, we can't really say anything, right? And so we're only in the last 15 years, there's been quite a little mini revolution in statistical mechanics where we now have some tools based in part on information theory that lets us talk about those things.
Yeah. Good. So I'm returning to this idea of, you know, remembering the past, I mean, or the time's arrow, the direction of cause. I mean, there's this very interesting quirk of the Big Bang in that it did create the situation where we can remember our past, but we can't remember our future, you know.
Right.
That idea of us, our inability to, we can imagine the future, and it's not the same thing as remembering the future.
Yeah.
What are the links there to free will?
Yeah, so let me just say one thing, because I don't want people to misunderstand. The fact that we remember the past and not the future is not a psychological fact. It's a fact about memories and records, right? Forget about our memories. There can be photographs of the past, but not photographs of the future, right? That's the same fact as we remember the past.
We haven't invented time machines yet, though.
No, that's right. But it's not supposed to be a claim about the brain or consciousness. It's just a claim about epistemology. We have a much greater epistemic anchor on the past than we do on the future, even though the laws of physics treat them equally. And the explanation for that is the low entropy of the Big Bang. So what it says about free will is exactly what you would expect it to say. Free will is supposed to say that we can make choices about the future, right? Nobody believes, no one who I've ever met, believes we can make choices about the past. Right? We would like to be able to do that. We would like to combine our knowledge of the past with the ability to change it by making choices now. But we can't. So we have a epistemic handle on the past. We know something about it. We don't know about the future, but we have a causal handle on the future in the usual folk way of talking about things. And so the connection of that with entropy is just the fact that since entropy is increasing, there's many, many possible futures. And since entropy was very low in the past, there are relatively few possible pasts compatible with what we know about it. So free will is enabled by our ignorance in this point of view, right? It's a reflection of the fact that we are complicated, chaotic, dynamical systems. We can't make predictions about ourselves very well. And therefore, the best you can say about a human being is that they are an agent making decisions with certain information, certain inclinations, certain preferences and predilections and so forth. And we call that free will. And if you don't want to call it free will, I don't care. Like, it doesn't really, people get very emotional about this one too.
Yeah.
I really can't get worked up about it. I don't care what you call it. But everybody, no matter how skeptical they are of free will, acts as if people make choices, okay? Why do they make choices about the future and not the past? Because the future is not anchored by the low entropy past condition near the Big Bang.
Right. There's obviously this deeply intertwined with the nature of consciousness, because what is the you that we're talking about that doesn't have access to all the fundamental, right? Because if there was a being, a universal consciousness that did have access in principle it wouldn't make sense to talk about choices because, you know, everything has already unraveled, you know?
Well, I would say it wouldn't make sense for that being to talk about choices, right. But as long as we don't have access to what that being knows,
right.
Then we talk about choices all the time.
That's why we talk about choices, right?
Yeah.
But who is the I that is self-aware of that fact that we don't have access to? You know, who is that person just talking just now? Like, you just talked to me, right? Like,
yeah,
there are
I
different
did.
Levels of reductionism that we can get at. And when we build up, you know, from the atomic level, there's some I, there's some conscious, self-aware I that can, to me, it's miraculous. I don't know if you find it just as, I know that you prefer wonder over awe, as you write in your books. I almost said awe-inspiring, but I shouldn't say that. I find it awe-inspiring.
Wondrous.
And I do find it one. I find both awe-inspiring and wondrous because I feel, I know that you don't like the reverence aspect of it, but I stand in a lot of humility, I stand like, holy cow, like that is pretty incredible that there did, like if the universe could, if there was a God, if there was a universe that was conscious, I think it would be pretty darn amazed that, holy cow, like, you know, when it comes back 14 billion years later, right? Like, let's say God like took a 14 billion year vacation and then God comes, which is understandable after how, how smooth God was in the beginning. I know. But it comes back 14 billion years. And it's like, wow, that evolved? Like, really? I think God would be in awe of that fact as well. That like, wow, that probably a random perturbation led to this random perturbation led to this, to the extent that we can actually like witness, we can witness the laws of nature unfolding. To me, that is just absolutely so incredible.
Yeah. And I think, you know, it's always hard to ask questions about how incredible something is or how surprising it should be, right? There are these results in quantum field theory that seem very surprising. And there are literally back and forth articles in the philosophy of science literature solely about the question, should we be surprised by this result? And you know, some people say, well, now that I understand, it's not surprising at all. But you didn't understand it, so it was surprising. So it could be surprising. Like, I don't want to deny anyone's surprise at this wonderful fact that consciousness has arisen, self-awareness and ability to grasp the universe in our minds, or at least part of the universe. Could I very easily imagine a somewhat deflationary story that says, you know, well, entropy is increasing and complexity arises as entropy increases before it then eventually fades away. And certain structures are metastable because they actually use free energy around them to increase the entropy of the universe. And in an information theoretic sense, these structures begin to represent the world around them because it helps them survive and go on through the world. And that information theoretic representation of the world, we can think of as knowledge in the brains or minds of these systems. And of course, knowledge of the self is an important part. And blah, blah, blah. So we could tell a story in which you would say, yeah, sure, that sounds like something that would happen. You know, I get both sides of that debate. I don't think there's a right or wrong there. I think that, you know, if I had just told you about the Big Bang and said, you know, what is it going to be like 14 billion years from now, chances you would have talked about human beings are very, very small. That I completely agree with. But can you demystify it after the fact by some scientific investigation? You know, that I'm willing to believe also.
Okay, well, let's try to demystify consciousness because I still do think it's incredible. And by the way, David Chalmers, the philosopher, he's a friend of mine, and we were talking about this, and he says he's going to be in your podcast, and maybe I shouldn't reveal this. So look, I can edit
go
that
ahead.
Out.
Yeah, that'll be a special bonus for listeners of your podcast that they will now know that David.
Okay. Okay. Well, you know, the top consciousness researchers are still kind of in awe of the fact that consciousness exists, right? Within psychology. So why are some physicists not as, you know, like you, for instance, do you not see the hard problem as hard as some people in our field see it?
Yeah, I think that's exactly the right way to put it. I don't see it as hard.
Yeah.
So by the way, this harkens back to when we were defining naturalism, because, you know, David Chalmers is an excellent example of someone who is a naturalist, but not a physicalist. Okay. So physicalists are subsets of naturalists. Naturalists think that there's only one world, the natural world. Physicalists think that all of the aspects of the natural world can be summarized as physical aspects, things happening in the world. David thinks there needs to be a whole nother category for mental properties in the world. He doesn't believe there's a separate spirit realm where there's disembodied brains or anything like that, but he believes that consciousness is not reducible to the physical goings on in the world. And I do. And again, belief, you know, we can talk about the degree of belief. Neither one of us is 100%, right? Okay. But we have our preferences. And yeah, you know, I think that, you know, let's put it this way. If, again, you took a background view and you didn't know who you were, and then you just asked yourself, like, of all the phenomena that we see in the universe, at some stage of scientific advancement, which is the thing we will understand the least? You know, consciousness would be a good bet, the thing we understand the least. It's like the most complicated thing being done by the most complicated thing that we know in the universe, the human brain, right?
Yeah.
It's zero surprise that we don't yet understand consciousness. And that involves, in my mind, both, you know, straightforward scientific understanding and also philosophical clarification of important concepts. So I think I both have specific disagreements with David's point of view and general ones. I don't think that zombies, philosophical zombies who act just like us but don't have consciousness, are even conceivable. Mm-hmm. I think that that's not a thing that could possibly happen, because I think that consciousness is just a manifestation of atoms talking about themselves in a particularly complicated way. There's an enormous road to go before we understand how that exactly plays out, but I don't see this barrier in principle to it playing out.
No, that's fair enough. I guess I don't understand why you're not as amazed that we went so many years after life existed. There are a lot of possibilities for that emergent, that complete. I mean, like, dolphins have a pretty complex neural system. There are other animals that do. Other animals don't come close to being as conscious as we are. Why, like, why us? And I'm not trying to get all, like, religious here all of a sudden.
Yeah,
and,
no, but
it's,
look,
pretty amazing. I shouldn't say miraculous, but yeah.
I think I don't think it's miraculous at all, or amazing at all. I think that that's a pretty obvious case of survivor's bias. Like, someone had to be first, and whoever was first, whichever species developed consciousness first, would have this conversation. Why us? How amazing is that? I'm not that impressed by us.
So far, I think that's, like, the only thing I can tell so far that differentiates us a little bit. Because I, in general, I actually really, and there's no actually about it, I really appreciate your spirit, your truth-seeking attitude, and I share that very much. But I tend to just walk around with so much wonder of the miraculousness of the fact that I can witness this impartial universe unfolding. I think it's just incredible that we've been giving, it's almost like a privilege. Like, you know, we talk in positive psychology about gratitude. But I feel like I want to coin a phrase. I was thinking about this the other day, existential gratitude. Like,
that's good. Yeah.
Would that be fair? Like, I feel like I walk around with a lot of existential gratitude in my life. And no one's talking about that in the field of positive psychology. We're talking about more mundane, you know, like, I'm so glad my mother, you know, baked that cake for me, or, you know, whatnot. But I walk around almost every day just like, the universe did not plan for us to be aware of it, you know?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that I actually love the phrase existential gratitude, because it's a good counterweight to existential despair, which people talk about all the time, right?
Right.
And we should be grateful, and that's great. But I keep wanting to say but, because I think, you know, we, like you said, we agree on most everything. But
we're both scientists, you know, first of all.
Let's concentrate on what we disagree on. That's where things are fun.
Yeah.
You know, I also think, and maybe this is the hidden positive psychologist within me, I also dwell on how crucially important it is to be grateful and appreciative of some of the many mundane things about life, right?
Yeah.
Some of the things that wouldn't be on most lists of the miraculous and the incredible, but, you know, a good slice of pizza, or, you know, when my cat jumps into my lap or whatever. And the phenomenon of consciousness is there. Like, I don't need it to be incredible to be grateful for it. Certainly the fact, I am impressed by many, many things. I'm impressed by the rate at which human beings have figured stuff out about the universe. I'm impressed with the wonderful variety of human experience and the things that we've done. And, you know, the obvious things, art and music and poetry and so forth. So I don't feel like I need to judge how likely or unlikely these things were to be impressed by them and grateful for them.
Okay, well, I appreciate your perspective, you know.
Okay.
I definitely appreciate it. So let's talk about the link between quantum reality and consciousness, because you're also skeptical that quantum mechanics will help us understand consciousness. Is that right?
Yeah, this is a very short conversation. There is no link between quantum reality and consciousness.
Yeah, sorry, what did you say? This is a long conversation?
There is a very short conversation.
Oh, short. Right. Well, you know, you sent me, and I'm very grateful you sent me some new material where you talk about that possibility. And it's obviously from both directions, right? So does consciousness play a role in accounting for quantum mechanics? And you would say no as well, right?
Right. Exactly. Yeah. I mean, there's no, so this is interesting and important and in my mind, more or less solved in both directions. So when quantum mechanics first came along, it comes along with a problem. The problem still exists called the measurement problem. What really happens when you measure a quantum system? What makes quantum mechanics so different and so difficult to understand compared to every pre-existing version of physics is that seemingly we need separate rules for what happens to physical systems when we're looking at them and when we're not looking at them. That's, you know, and why is that? What exactly are those rules? Do we really need them? This is the measurement problem. The witty short motto for this is quantum mechanics says that what exists is very different than what you see, and inescapably so. So it was natural then to imagine in the early days that, well, since the act of observation or seeing or looking is something that human beings do, maybe that to explain this problem, we need to understand something about consciousness. Maybe the human consciousness really changes the world when you look at it in an important way, or even brings the world into existence in some interesting way. And, you know, people are still welcome to believe that. People can believe whatever they want, but it's absolutely false to say we can't account for quantum measurements unless there's something special about consciousness. There's perfectly good explanations for the measurement problem now that didn't exist in the 1930s that have nothing to do with consciousness or human perception at all. So, you know, you're welcome to believe those things, but there's no need for it or evidence in favor of them.
Yeah, you know, some of this may sound really technical to our listeners. I just want to impress upon everyone just how profound this argument you're making is, because it does. You know, as far as I see it, this gets at the crux of whether or not we live after death, because the only thing we care about living after death is our consciousness. I mean, when we really get down to it, it is our, you know, that there's some continuity of some sort of awareness. Our memories can persist in some way, and our awareness of those memories. If those memories exist and we're not aware of them, then it's like, what's the point, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So
exactly.
So this does get at the heart of, like, you know, like, is there life after death? I mean, the question, is there life after death? Like, that is one of the most pressing questions of humankind. And it sounds like you're like 99% certain there is no life after death.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. And that's so cool that we could so objectively and rationally and coolly just answer that question. Like,
right. And, you know, again, I don't want to be dismissive of people who disagree with me here, because some of them are very smart and I admire them in any sorts of numbers of ways.
I'm going to haunt you after.
Yeah, you know, that's exactly. I'm also setting myself up for a real, you know, Pascal's wager kind of comeuppance here. But so I'm not saying things, because I have other people that I'm interviewing for my podcast that I will be talking about these issues with. So stay tuned to future episodes of the Mindscape podcast.
Yeah.
To hear more discussion about these things. But yeah, I think that consciousness, as far as we can tell, is inextricably twined to the stuff that is happening in your body and your brain. I mean, there's no evidence for consciousness happening in the absence of brains. Let's put it that way. That's a fairly weak claim, right?
Yeah.
I talk in my book, In the Big Picture, about the story of Princess Elizabeth, who I want to, you know, act as her public relations advisor because she needs a lot more credit. She was the one who challenged Descartes on his mind-body dualism based on the idea that, you know, he hadn't specified how the mind and body should interact with each other. Mm-hmm. And these days, philosophers call this the interaction problem. And I think what you're getting at here is that what I claim in the book anyway, is that we now know so much more about the body than Descartes did. We know that our bodies are made of atoms. We know that our atoms are made of electrons and protons and neutrons. We know the equations that govern how those particles move around. So as much as Elizabeth was able to say there's no room for this immaterial mind to affect your body, that problem is a million times harder now. There's just no way to alter the equations of physics in any sort of harmless way that would allow something other than those physical electrons and protons and neutrons, et cetera, to do their thing. So that doesn't mean it's impossible. That means it's a huge burden on those who would have that be the case to show how you could change the laws of physics as we know them. And if you don't, then there can't be any life after death. Then, you know, the laws of physics as we know them are unambiguous about that. And I need to emphasize, as we know them, you know, they could be wrong. It's just that there's zero evidence that they're wrong in the relevant regime. There's zero reason to believe it. And attempts to change them to make this happen are, you know, range from non-existent to abysmal failures. So as a good Bayesian, calculating my credences,
yeah,
the credence that somehow the information, like these days, neuroscientists can locate which neuron certain memories are associated with, right?
Yeah.
If that neuron is not there anymore, how can the memory be there anymore? There's just no way for that to happen.
Yeah, and I agree with that. But, you know, can you use the human imagination to think of some possibility that there is a life after death? Not that possibility, because I agree with you that when the physical system supporting consciousness is no longer in existence, it's kind of hard. It'll be hard for consciousness to exist. Yes, I agree with that. But can you imagine the possibility of, like, my friends and I, we sit around, we're not physicists, but we like think of, well, maybe like the universe is not infinite. We don't know for a fact that it is infinite. And how do we know that it like doesn't loop back on itself? Like when we die, there's going to be an infinite or a really long time that we're dead, but there might be hope that there'll be like a time, maybe 4 trillion years, it'll feel like a second to us, but where that constitution of atoms that made us us somehow reconfigures itself just through chance.
Yeah, but it won't be you.
Oh, I tried.
It won't be you.
That's, I tried.
This is crucially
important.
Well,
how do you know it won't be? I mean, all I am from a physics point of view, as you made note, is, you know, this really improbable pattern of atoms. I mean, how do you know that, like, given enough
pattern.
A persistent pattern. And so it's the persistent part that's important here, isn't it?
Yeah. So, you of course, for every time, well, it's not clear that we do, but let's imagine we live in a world where random fluctuations continue infinitely far into the future, okay? Then, since you are made of a finite number of particles in a finite region of space, if you have an infinite amount of time for random fluctuations to happen, something just like you will appear an infinite number of times. However, for every one time that happens, there will be an enormously larger time when something kind of like you appears, but not really exactly the same. Like, every possible variation on you. It's Borges's infinite library, right? So, and all of these will say, like, well, did I just fluctuate into existence? Or, you know, they'll have false memories or whatever. There's no useful sense in which any of those are you or descended from you or anything like that. The idea of a person, we talk about emergent phenomena, right? Tables and chairs are useful categories because they have certain properties, which include the fact that they stick around. You know, they're here and they're here again, you know, the next moment, et cetera. People are the same way. People are collections of atoms arranged in a certain pattern. Most of our atoms, by the way, you know, don't last through our body the whole lifespan, right?
My 4-year-old self is dead. Yeah.
Dead is not the right word, but your atoms are not there anymore, except for maybe in your teeth or something like that.
Non-existent.
has evolved into something else. But there's a reason why it is useful to categorize your 4-year-old self and your present self as different moments in the life of the same person. There is zero reason to categorize yourself now and yourself 10 to the 10 to the 120 years from now that fluctuate into existence as different moments in the life of the same person.
So you can't think of any legitimate physics thing that could surprise you where, like, you didn't think of it now. You know, let's say you die and then something happens where you are still, maybe like some atom is conscious, like, but it's not a body anymore or something. Like, and like, can you imagine something that still obeys the laws of physics where there's hope that we live after we die? Or you're like 99.9 repeating sure that that's not going to happen?
Yeah, no, I mean, if you added on that obeys the laws of physics, like if you want to obey the laws of physics, whenever you ask a theoretical physicist, can you imagine?
Yeah.
The answer is always sure. If I try hard enough, I can do it. I remember.
That's very funny. It's true.
If we have 2 minutes to digress, you know, I sometimes act as a science consultant for movies.
Cool.
And the movies are usually written even before I get to look at them. So it's more a matter of like cleaning some things up, not adding new ideas. So once we were doing this movie and the actress who was going to play a physicist wanted to come to Caltech to talk to some real physicists. So I introduced her and one of the producers to some of my graduate students. And they explained the plot of the movie, which is utterly implausible by physicist standards. And, you know, so they explained it to the grad students and said, you know, well, so what, how would you explain this physically, you know, if this had happened. And the grad students are like, nope, that cannot happen. That would never happen. And so then I explained to them, I said, look, when you have a movie plot, don't think of the plot of the movie as a new theory. Think of the plot of the movie as data. You don't have the option of not believing it, right? You're forced to explain it. How would you explain it? 5 minutes later, they had like 20 different explanations that they'd come up with, right? So can I imagine ways that despite everything we know about the laws of physics, some knowledge...
You're so cynical.
I am. No, I'm just a good abductor. I'm a good Bayesian.
Yeah. And there's a rational part of me that agrees with that. Yeah. Yes. There's a rational part. Now, it must really frustrate you then when you're talking to someone who is really religious and says, well, you're just not open enough or you're not in touch with God like I am. That argument must frustrate you.
Well, it does, because I don't think it's a sensible argument. I mean, it, just like the arrogance argument, you know, like, yeah. Is it more arrogant for me to say the universe that we see is all there is than to say that, oh, I have personal knowledge of an infinite omnipotent being? That
That's a great point. That is such a great point. Which that you're right. You're right. Yeah. Both are kind of arrogant in a way.
Yeah. So, I mean, people can always say, look, it's possible. I mean, that among the things that are possible to imagine is that there are ways to access the world that different people have different capabilities in, right? I mean, this is what Alvin Plantinga believes, right? That there is a divine sense, sensus divinatus, in some of us, but not in others. And he says atheists just don't experience it.
Right.
So if you believe that, you know, again, my Bayesian prior for that would be very small. I think, you know, I'm tempted to say that I don't have that, but I have a sensus bullshittius that says that, you know, maybe you just made that up. But it could be right. It's absolutely possible in that case that they have access to information that I don't have. But you have to make your choices about layer credences.
Yeah. This is so much fun. Let's end this podcast talking about if we accept as true the 99% probability these things are true, how should we live our life, right? So you have this whole section of your book on caring and morality leading up to existential therapy. So I want to end this podcast talking about that because this is very important. So Carl Sagan has this quote, "We are star stuff, which has taken its destiny into its own hands." Now, first of all, I find that absolutely awe-inspiring. So Carl Sagan says that, and I'm in awe, you know, at the fact that we are a species that can take the destiny into our own hands. And I was thinking about morality in the sense, like, every time we make a choice to take the moral decision when we're faced with a dilemma, to me, that's the true test of free will. And I wanted to run that by you because in a way, we're kind of defying the universe. Every time that we, and I know that sounds too grandiose, but, you know, it just seems to me like there's a certain satisfaction we get when we don't give in to some impulse that is destructive, and instead we choose the choice that is growth-oriented or healthy or caring or even caring, you know? We can use the word caring. There's something about that, you know, and also the sense of, like, consciousness and self. I mean, there's this really interesting research shows that we can lose our memory of, you know, like, facts that we learned in high school, et cetera, but as long as our moral sense is intact, we still feel a sense of self. So there's something about this moral. Yeah.
So, I mean, I think there's a couple of background things to say, and then I'll try to answer the question. You know, in that section of the book called Caring, some people got frustrated because my personal interest in that section was more on meta-ethics and meta-morality and meta-meaning rather than ethics and morality and meaning. So I didn't tell anyone how to behave or how to find meaning in their lives, right? I talked about what it would mean to find meaning in your life, what it might mean to come up with rules for being a good person and stuff like that. And people don't want that. People want rules. Like, people are like, tell me what to do. You know, that's what I want. Even if I disagree with you, I want you to say there are rules so I can disagree with you, not just give me a platform for thinking about it.
You mean like Jordan Peterson's... The rules.
I know. Yeah,
of
you know
life.
That's why he sold more copies than I did.
Yeah,
you know,
it's
one of the reasons. So, but having said that, there's some, you know, perfectly kind of obvious aspects to making choices that are moral and ethical and good and meaningful and so forth. The reason why I called the book or the section "Caring" is because I think that what we have to work with is the fact that we all care about stuff. You can care about things in a bad way, right? Like, you can have, you know, bad motivations and care about, you know, doing them. Revenge is something you might care about. But that's the starting point for me for developing, you know, our personal views on morality and meaningfulness and so forth. So, I mean, I think what you're saying is good as a more substantive direction to move in when it comes to bringing meaning and morality to our lives. You know, we can, and you're a psychologist, you're better at this than I am, but we can imagine that there are sort of the simple things to do and the more challenging things to do. And in some sense, you know, there's a struggle between system one and system two, maybe, or at least between the most obvious heuristics that get used to get through the day versus more reflective, carefully thought out things. I think that's an aspect of free will, you know, but I would also call free will what happens when I choose to wear the white shirt or the black shirt, you know, in the morning. I don't think it needs to be fraught with moral weight. But yeah, you know, I think this idea of, and it goes back to the idea of, you know, explaining the brain and personality by entropy considerations.
Yeah.
As wonderful as it would be to explain things by simple principles, I think that when it comes to complex systems like life, there's so much more often a tension at work, right? And it's not one overarching thing that gets minimized or maximized, but a competition between different things. And you're right that it, you know, very roughly speaking, I think that John Stuart Mill would have told us that we have, you know, higher desires and lower desires or something like that, higher pleasures and lower pleasures. And, you know, want to work to sort of boost up the higher ones a little bit. I think that's a wonderful thing to do. It is definitely the kind of thing that a poetic naturalist would be happy to endorse.
Yeah. And also, I see a lot of similarities to one of my favorite psychotherapists, Raoul Amey. I don't know if you've read his writings on existential humanistic psychotherapy. I mean, he's been one of my biggest influences. He talks a lot about caring as simply just throwing your weight, you know, for something. And in his book, you know, Love and Will, I highly would recommend you read Love and Will, actually. I'd love to like grab a beer with you someday and discuss Love and Will. You know.
Sure. But,
so I think it's very much in line with your thinking about desire and care as intertwined. You talk about, you know, relating to this point of there's no Ten Commandments, you didn't want to put it forward. And I really appreciate that because there's such a push to write self-help book these days,
right?
Where you have a certain number of things.
I reserve the right to write a self-help book someday.
good. And, you know, it makes a lot more money, I'm sure.
Yeah, well, you know, we got to, it's a crowded market, but yeah, you got to have an angle.
You need an angle. So these 10 guides that you put forward, you know, I'll call them guides to living or, but obviously.
Considerations.
I like that a lot. You know, I really like this one about how there's no natural way to be.
Yeah.
We are the final product of a cacophony of competing impulses. This seems very relevant to what we're just discussing about morality and over rising above our competing impulses. You say we're the final product of a cacophony of competing impulses, and so are other people. It's that we are not simple, unified, fixed creatures. We have inclinations, desires, partly born of our innate dispositions, but we also have the opportunity to change as individuals and as a society. So there is an optimism here at the end of the book that even though we're in this totally meaningless universe and we're all going to die and like all these other things we figured out here, still in this short lifespan that we have, we still have the opportunity to make others better as well as ourselves better, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that, I mean, maybe in retrospect, I had this in mind and might even have said it, but didn't emphasize it nearly enough. The poetic naturalist will accept both that we have basic instincts, desires, things that are given to us by evolution or things that are just accidental or whatever. And we have higher cognitive capacities, which allow us to take those basic ingredients and shape them, right? And it's, you know, you can't, I think that, again, too many people want to say like, well, we're just, you know, beasts in the wild giving in to our evolutionary desires, or we are perfectly rational, or we should try to be perfectly rational things. I think that the interface of those two things or the relationship between those two things is central. David Hume, who I really like, you know, reason is the slave of the passions. Like, you know, your passions tell you where to start going and reason will help get you there. And one of the things that reason can say is, you know what, that passion was a bad idea. And I think this is what it means to do moral philosophy in a morally constructivist framework, where you think that morality is not out there to be located in the world by, you know, rationality or scientific experiment. It's something we make up. That leaves us with an enormous amount of work to do. You know, what are we going to make up? Like, where do we start? How are we going to do it? And certainly our rationality and higher cognitive functions play a huge role in that.
Certainly. You know, in this recent Scientific American article, I wrote about what would be the implications if we all believed that we're all one. You know, a lot of spiritual people believe. And there is a sense, as I'm reading this book and understanding the latest laws of physics, there is a sense in which we're all one, in a sense we all are living under the same fundamental laws of nature. So,
absolutely.
You know, some scientists have started to look at what would happen if we all really believed it. And in a sense, it's not a belief. It's actually the truth. And so I want to end this podcast day with this great quote from your book. All lives are different and some face hardships that others will never know, but we all share the same universe, the same walls of nature, and the same fundamental task of creating meaning and of mattering for ourselves and those around us in this brief amount of time we have in this world. Look, Sean, I consider it miraculous that and improbable that I got a chance to talk to you today about whether or not we matter in this impartial universe. So I have a lot of existential gratitude for this chat today. So thank you.
Darn it, I was going to say I have a lot of existential gratitude, but you took it from me. But,
I did.
great pleasure for me, too. Yeah, it was a lot of fun, a lot to think about here. We should talk again sometime.
I'd love that. Thanks for listening to the Psychology Podcast. I hope you enjoyed this episode. If you'd like to react in some way to something you heard, I encourage you to join in the discussion at thepsychologypodcast.com. That's thepsychologypodcast.com. Also, please add a rating and review of the Psychology Podcast on iTunes. Thanks for being such a great supporter of the podcast, and tune in next time for more on the mind, brain, behavior, and creativity.
Trinity School of Natural Health can help you be part of the fast-growing health and wellness industry. With an education that empowers communities, Trinity grads can change lives by applying natural health principles and techniques in holistic practices or stores selling nourishing health products. Offering 19 online programs that fit your busy schedule, you'll get training to help turn your passion into a career. Enroll today at trinityschool.org. That's trinityschool.org.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. It's a simple truth. No matter who you are, mental health challenges can affect you, and how you manage them can make all the difference. That's why everyone should have access to mental health support that meets them where they are and helps them get through. BetterHelp provides online therapy on your schedule. It's flexible, simple to use, and more affordable than in-person therapy. Connect with a licensed therapist selected just for you. Learn more at BetterHelp.com. That's BetterHelp.com.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cb for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.